total package. Microphone check, is this thing really on? What? We got that new Drake. Oh man, you know I love this. Pamela, DJ P. Chris.
Yeah, nice for what?
I love it, and it's a lot of good new music that dropped. Cardi B came out with her album, and I like it. I like it. It's my favorite track.
Right. On her. I like it like that. Pretty dope.
I like it. Is your favorite?
Yeah.
No. What's your favorite?
I love the album, but I have some Moneybag through the phone.
Well, that's probably
she speaks my mind when I'm angry.
From the last, from our, one of our other podcasts through the phone, I can see why you like that.
No. I just love it. She like she want a tits on a gram.
I think I like it like that. It's more like a spring summertime anthem. Like it's feeling good. That. Got the sunroof open.
I gotta get Brenda to translate it for me. Like I don't know what they're saying. My friend Brenda.
But so guys, this weekend I had the pleasure, absolute pleasure, of going to the Kennedy Center this past weekend, and they had a I don't know if you're familiar with the author name Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes.
Yes. So Jada McCrae's joining us. Ta-Nehisi Coates is an author. He is from Baltimore originally. Mm-hmm. He went to Howard University. He wrote a book called Between the World and Me. And there's only been so Apollo Theater and could give a shout out to Camila Forbes. She is executive producer of this theatrical performance of Between Your World and Me. But Between Your World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates, he won the National Book Award in 2015 for this book. As I said, he's from Baltimore. He went to Howard. And this book is a letter to his son, his 15-year-old son named Samari, just talking about what it means to be Black in America. And he chronicles Michael Brown and a couple of other people who were killed by police brutality. And it was such a moving performance, right? Because I think they've only had three shows. They had two at the Apollo and the one at the Kennedy Center, and Paletta Washington, Denzel Washington's wife. Mm-hmm. So basically, it was like an audiobook live, right? So we had Paletta Washington, who's Denzel Washington's wife. We had Savion Glover. We had the actress from This Is Us. I forgot her name, who plays the wife. Mm-hmm. She was she read an excerpt. We had a Black Thought read an excerpt. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an amazing.
Yeah.
And Joe Morton, who plays
Papa Pope on Scandal.
Yes, on Scandal. Yes. So all of these people kind of went up and did an excerpt, right? Read an excerpt. And then also it was kind of like the music that was behind it. Jason Moran, who was the jazz musician who did the score for it. We were crying.
Mm.
People in the theater were actually crying. Mm-hmm. The first show was sold out. I was able to get tickets for the second show they did at 2:00 that afternoon. But I mean, at the very end, they showed like all of the people who, I mean, the list was just going on and on and on, that were, you know, victims of police brutality, right?
Yeah.
And everyone just stood there for like, I guess, like 5 minutes in silence, just seeing all of these names scroll, and people just it just took the breath out of the room.
Right. I can only imagine the book. I had to put the book down several times.
Yes.
Because I would become overwhelmed reading the book.
Yes.
So I can only imagine watching a performance of that material. Yes.
So as I said, it was very amazing, and they're not doing many shows. And I said they brought it to D.C. And he's going to be here. He's going to be here May 17th.
Here in Baltimore?
In Baltimore, yes, at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He's going to be talking about Afrofuturism.
That's one of my favorite topics.
I'm into that now. Well, you know, which if you're not unfamiliar with that, it's just, you know, Black. When you look at Black Panther, and as I said, he's a comic. He writes for Black Panther as well.
Okay.
He writes some of the strip, right. And he's also going to be doing Captain America as well, writing the comic strip for that as well. So anyway, so it made me start thinking, and I wanted to share that, and I wanted to bring in Miss Jada McCrae.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. To talk about, I don't have children, but in light of everything that's happening, right? And he was inspired to write this book because after he had a conversation with President Obama mm-hmm. about the state of Black people in America, mm. right? And he wrote this book, and I said it's one, he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist mm-hmm. for this book, and he wanted to discuss, you know, he wanted to discuss all of this stuff and how it impacts, you know, having a child and then having that child mm-hmm. leave your house every day, mm-hmm. right? Because his friend, Prince Carmen Jones,
yes.
Was killed in, wow. and he talks about it in the book mm-hmm. and how that affected mm-hmm. him and how he had to kind of, you know, wrap his head around mm-hmm. that and then also explain it to his son, like, what do I tell you? I can't protect you when you go out there in the world.
You know, he grabs you from the beginning with the book, the very beginning, and he spoke about his son's realization of who he was in America as a Black man in America. I think it was with Eric Garner or was it Mike yes. Brown? It was with Eric Garner. And I related to that so much because his son comes to this realization. His son believes that justice will be served.
Yeah, it was Mike Brown.
Mike Brown. Yes, thank mm-hmm. you. His son believes that justice will be served. And when he finds out that it's not going to be and that no one's going to be charged and that this man died and no one's going to be held responsible for it, his son just kind of withdraws and goes into his room. And when I read that, I remember, I call it my first on the list, the long list. The first one for me was Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, I went to an HBCU and, you know, you had the quote unquote woke people who would talk about racial disparities and, you know, all that stuff. And we were somewhat, I would say, we were woke-ish back then. But I think that Trayvon Martin was my first experience. I remember I was on vacation with my family. I had just had my son who was still a baby, about 2 years old, really. And and I remember when George Zimmerman was acquitted mm-hmm. and the yeah. crushing blow
yes.
that mm-hmm. was to me. And just to watch the media kind of demonize this little boy
yes.
who just happened to smoke marijuana and got suspended from school. Yeah. And then all
Skittles.
Of a sudden,
Skittles. Yes.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden it made it. He was because he had gotten in trouble in school before, it was as if it was justification for him to be murdered
right. mm-hmm.
walking in his own neighborhood mm-hmm. by this random man who decided that he was the law.
Vigilante, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so I think about that and his parents on TV and this was, I just, again, my son was about two years old when this happened and I remember thinking about the joy that this little boy brings me and how beautiful he is and how loving he is and kind he is and just all of these things. He's so effervescent and has always been that way since he was born. And I looked at him and I realized this country does not care about you mm-hmm. and they don't see you that way and they will never see you that way. And I just got this, it was just this, I think it was this hurt. Because up until this point, I think we all believed that there was some sort of justice.
Yeah.
That if, you know, these things happened in the 50s and the 30s it's and the 40s. And it happened then, but we didn't get it on videotape.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, things are different now. We have a Black president. This is when Obama was in office. And we all had this hope that things had changed. And finally, things were different for us. And that our children wouldn't have to suffer the same things. And I remember this happened. And I looked at his parents on TV. And I saw, you know, how Fox News would just go in. And if you ever... never read comments on any article ever, but just the way they demonized this boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought his parents loved him the way that I love my child.
Right.
Somebody carried him in their belly
yes.
and they cherished him and that was their baby. And he was murdered. In America, a lot of people in America
thought it was justification.
They thought it was justification
yeah, yeah, yeah,
for
yeah, yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Question for you.
Can we just kind of introduce who Jada is?
Oh, so I'm sorry, y'all. I get super passionate. I jumped the gun. I'm so sorry. So,
Good point, Tanya.
Jada, tell us about yourself.
Oh, my name is Jada McCray. I'm an LCSWC, which is a licensed clinical social worker. And I'm the executive director for BTSD Services, which is an outpatient mental health clinic. How much do you want me to say?
Oh, no, that's great. And we brought you in because we wanted to discuss, you know, just that impact mm-hmm. and having that conversation with your children.
Yes.
So, you know, Jenny, good. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure our audience
understood. No, I didn't remember last she hadn't introduced herself. Yes. So I'm glad we...
Well, it's because you know who I am.
Yes. Okay. So my question for you is that you stated your first realization that, okay, the United States doesn't necessarily care about that little mm-hmm. Black boy was when Trayvon Martin was killed and you realized that George Zimmerman was going to get off, mm-hmm. right? For me, I was just as crushed and I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a reminder.
Mm-hmm.
I had several instances in my life prior to that
yeah.
where I knew exactly what this country was.
Oh, yeah.
So my question for you is, prior to that happening, had you personally had any instances with the law or Caucasian people for that matter that had already brought that realization to you? Or was this literally like your first real, like, wow, maybe this shit is as fucked up, excuse my language, but as it seems?
You know, what I can say is I think that I grew up in Baltimore City for the most part. I'm an Army brat, but we came back here when I was about 9 years old. And so, and of course, my family is Black. So I had the same conversations that everyone else, everybody knows the conversations that you have in a Black family. But I think that as you grow, and I went to an HBCU and then I went to the University of Maryland, and then I begin to have jobs, and your world starts to mix a little bit, and you have more exposure to white people, and you realize, oh, we both like Friends. Oh, we both, you know what I mean? We like songs about Jane. You know what I mean? That was Maroon 5. But, you know, you find these things that you have in common and you believe, you know, you have more in common than you have that's different from you. And you see, you start to see things in a different way. So you start to, and I think that this is the thing that brings about the rage and the anger in Black people a lot, is that you start to have hope. That maybe, just maybe, it's not as bad as we believe it to be. Maybe, just maybe, things will change. But then every now and then you'll have instances like this where things will just come crashing down, and the reality of it will come crashing down. And I think that for most African Americans, it's the loss of good gracious, the audacity to hope. You know, not to sound super corny, but that's what it is, the realization that you, at any given moment, your life means nothing. And the lives of who you hold dear means absolutely nothing. And we believe that if we do everything right, because that's what we're told, that we are the link, we are the weak link in the chain. And that if you go to school and you keep your nose clean and you keep your head above water, if you do right and you mind your business and you know, there's an opportunity for you and your children. But what we find over and over and over again is that's not the case.
It's not true.
How many people have quote unquote made it out, and then they're kind of held up to this public scrutiny afterwards? So we're gonna let you make it. You'll make it, but then after you make it, we'll find that flaw. We'll find that thing, and then we'll persecute you. We'll remind you of who you actually are. So I think that that's the painful thing, is that, and I've experienced this personally in my life as well, and also professionally too, when you are reminded of who you are in case you forgot. And so my experience with my son has been this. Ever since the Trayvon Martin thing, I realized that as a Black mother, I have to be conscious of who he is in the world, so that the reality for him is always there, so that he's never misled to believe that this world is anything other than what it is. So yes, we want to make sure that you get the best education you possibly can. We want to give you every advantage, you know, every advantage that you can. And people will tell you, like, for my children, I ride hard for my children. You go to school in the afternoon, you know, you go to school, when you come home in the afternoon, people know there's a block of time I don't answer my phone, because I'm going to make you a home-cooked meal. We're going to sit down and review the schoolwork that you already did. Yes, you're doing school twice. Yes, you have to take swimming. Yes, you have to play a sport. All in, you know, in the summertime, there's foreign language classes that you have to take to give you the best chance at life, period. But never forget who you are. And never think that you can educate or monetize your way out of it, because you cannot.
Nope. Yeah, and I think that's kind of what happens, I think, with Obama. When Obama was elected, yes, there was this, you know, kumbaya moment. You saw white people, you saw black people just looking, and we were just like, wow, like the country is coming together, and you know, we are progressive.
Wait, am I the only person that didn't fall for that? Like...
Yes, you are alone. Yes.
You know, I've had some very personal, like interactions. Oh, God. Okay.
I mean, because you're saying it, so I'm like, what did happen? Right. You know?
No. I was going to get into it. I just wanted to give chance for us to warm up into this episode before it got all deep. But actually, again, I'm very open about this, but it ties into our last episode with domestic violence and all of that. Yeah. So, if you guys listened to our previous episode, I didn't go into detail, but I said it was one particular situation that really ended the situation between the two of us. And again, without going into too much detail, because it's a really long story, but we got into a really bad fight. But at this point, we were not together. So he came to my apartment where I was living with my girlfriends, and he pulled me out of the house. We get to outside, and it becomes like a physical altercation. We end up, and at some point in this situation, I black out. Like, your adrenaline is running, and I don't know what happened, but I know that when I came to, there was a flashlight in my face. My girlfriends were standing there, and he was standing there. And the flashlight was the police. And I was like on the ground. I had on half of my clothes, but not all of my clothes. Wow. Obviously, I wasn't raped, but the altercation led to my clothes being ripped off of me. The officer, instead of asking me, was I okay or did I need anything? He said, nigga, get up.
Wow.
What? And I was like, what?
Virginia.
Wow.
And it was Virginia. Right. Wow. Right. And he's like, no, get up, get up. And he's like pulling me up off the ground, but I don't know what's happening. And so the guy says, oh, she hit me. She hit me. And he's like, oh, you hit him? Keep in mind, we're both black, right? Yeah. So it really didn't matter to them. But at the end of the day, he tells him that he could charge me. He makes me give him my social security number.
Oh, no.
All of my personal information and says, you want to file charges against her? Here you go. Do so. Mm. And I'm looking at him and I'm bloody and all of these things. I'm like, I need help. He's like, oh, figure it out on your own.
Wow.
What?
Oh
my God.
So that was my own personal experience. But then there were other experiences in my life where my grandfather would tell me stories of him being pulled over and they telling him, oh, you're just the nigga with woolly hair. Mind you, my grandfather had the farthest thing from woolly hair, but that's just what they saw him as.
Well, that's just to remind you.
That's just to remind you. Or I had just started dating Chris and I remember him calling and being like, I'm on the side of the curb on Security Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why? And he's with clients at this point because this is when he's used to work one-on-one with clients. And I come and they have them like handcuffed, lined up on Security Boulevard for nothing because he assumed that they were drug dealers and that the little boys were, I guess, his mules. I don't know. Not realizing that he was helping them and working with them. So I had enough reminders that at this point I'm like, I love people in general, regardless of the race, but I'm always be cognizant of our interactions.
You know, and that's crazy because I guess I'm not going to win, but I've never, you know, I haven't had that experience, right? And it wasn't until we were driving back from D.C. and we were at an event at Park and this guy was like, hey, you know, we all going back to Baltimore. Let's hop in the car. So we all hop in the car and he has it's a Benz or something, or Beamer, I don't remember, but Benz or Beamer. And we're driving down 295 and he gets pulled over. Right. So, and it's like four of us in the car, right? I think four of us in the car. And we start having a conversation. He's like, oh, I always get pulled over. Mm. I'm like, really? Right. And he's like, this is because his windows are a little bit tinted, you know, darker than, and he's like, yeah. And then the guys in the car started having conversations like, yeah, they always get pulled over.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a black woman,
it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. You know what I mean? To us. So I was just like, that was part of their life. You know what I mean? Like they expected that. And it just kind of opened my eyes like this, you're driving a luxury car down 295. Like the odds as a black man, as the odds of you being getting pulled over or higher than anyone else.
Yeah. But even after Sandra Bland, we can't really have the luxury of as black women to say that we're safe. You know, I mean, again, another person, another name on the list, the very, very long list, the 5-minute long list, who was pulled over and died. I mean, not died. She was murdered. I guess there's some speculation about whether or not she committed suicide. But let's just put it this way. She was healthy when she went into custody, was on her way to a new job, and was functional enough to be getting a new job, and somehow was pulled over by the police and ended up dead.
Yeah.
So now we even have to be, I was pulled over about two Thanksgivings ago. I was pulled over and I called 911 to say, I'm being pulled over. I just want to make sure. But I wanted to do that, not just so I can make sure that it was a real police car, because I knew it was a real police car, but I just needed it to be documented somewhere that Jada McCray made a phone call when she was pulled over. And also it puts the officer on alert as well. This is a smart cookie. So like if she called in to you know, to see if I'm real, then that means that she knows her rights at least somewhat.
Yeah. And just going back to the book, you know, and it's not just a black and white thing, because with Prince Carmen Jones, he was murdered by a black police officer, right? In PG County, you know, which is like the blackest county.
It is.
And with really wealthy African Americans that live there as well. And so, you know, it comes back to the culture, right?
Yeah. Yes, it comes back to, and he said this in the book as well, that America has always been a place for free people, but it depends on the definition of people. And so when you think about the value of black bodies and the way that we're taught from the time that we are born, even before we're born, actually, when we're on a, you know, when you're in your mother's stomach and you think about the health care that she may receive, this is how systems of oppression work. The health care that your mother may receive and how you come into this world. It's been studies that have shown that nurses and doctors are less responsive to the pain of a black woman. So you think about
that and you think about the nutrition that she may or may not have had, and how Black people often live in areas with food deserts, and they don't have the education or know about or have access to organic foods or foods that are good for them while they're pregnant. So you think about how this begins before you're even born, the value of your body before you're even born. So you think about that, and when you get here, the treatment that you get once you get here, and how you're bombarded with all of these messages from the time that you are very, very young. And I think about myself, we are very proud to be Black in my household. We accept all people, but we're proud to be who we are. And my daughter, she has 1,000,001 Black dolls. She has, I mean, every Black doll with every hue. My husband was in Target with her one day. And of course, you know, he don't know no better. So he got her blonde hair, blue eye, you know, Miss USA Barbie doll. And do you know the doll that she clung to?
That one.
She will tell you all day long that her skin is beautiful, that her hair is beautiful, that she is a beautiful Black girl. She'll tell you this all day long because this is what we enforce in her. But the messages that she receives is that this is outside, the doll. Yeah. All of these beautiful dolls that you have, and this little one in this little bathing suit that's painted onto her body with a broken leg, is the one that is the one that should be treasured and valued.
I've seen that doll in your back seat.
It's unfortunate, isn't it? Yeah. It upsets me. I try not to throw away on the low, you know.
Yeah, and you know, and I said, coming from a West Indian background, I have a different outlook. My household had a different outlook than, you know, being born here and having generations of people born here, right? Mm-hmm. And as you said, like, you know, you have conversations with your grandfather, and other people have conversations with people in their family, right? That had this, things have happened to them generation after generation. And I can't have that conversation because that never really happened to my grandparents, right? Because growing up in Guyana was just a completely, totally different experience where, you know, it's a country of color, right? So you don't have that Black and white kind of disparity, even though there's colorism there, it's just completely different when it's between, you know, Black people and white people and then the different oppressions. And I think it wasn't until I read another book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which really kind of just showed me some of the things that Black African-Americans had to go through, especially people coming from the South, and why there was like a huge exodus of people during a certain time period that left the South because it was so oppressive, and how they had to escape to the North for even though the North had its issues as well, it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't as oppressed, bad, being with all the lynchings. And I said, there was a new museum, right, that Oprah showed on 60 Minutes. That
And people had the nerve to be offended.
That talked, and she was like, you know, there was thousands of people, I think it's in Alabama, and thousands of people that they have with the different stories of them being lynched, and there's thousands of people that are undocumented, right?
It was genocide.
Yes.
It was genocide.
Absolutely. It was just like a few years ago that there is a town in Mississippi that was just desegregated as far as their school system.
Like, oh yeah, I read about that.
This stuff still exists, and what I think as far as people of color, I think we kind of get immune or used to certain things, right? We're categorized as being sensitive. So someone can say something or do something, you kind of check yourself, like, am I being overly sensitive? Like, is this person really coming off as being racist or even ignorant? I mean, myself personally, you said that you're an Army brat. Jada, I'm an Army brat as well. I've been the only Black child in my class a lot of times with racist teachers who have said stuff like, go back to where you came from. I remember I had a teacher during Black
that
History Month.
That
girl's trouble, right? All of those things. Or look for anything to get me in trouble. Great grades and everything else, but anything I did was, you know, highlighted. I remember there was a time that my teacher was teaching about Black History Month, and all the children were on the little rug, and we're sitting around the teacher, and she's reading a book, and she's like, Harriet Tubman led the Underground Railroad. Isn't that right, Pamela? So every fact she would say, isn't that right, Pam?
Are you a spokesperson? Like,
so I'm like, did you march with Mom, Pam?
I'm like, I'm only 9 or 10 years old. I'm learning like everyone else.
Pam, you were there.
I was there.
Time traveler.
I know about everything Black. So, you know, just little instances like that up until now, being in the position that I'm in. I'm a property manager. And I know a lot of people come into my office and they're like, well, can I speak to the manager? Oh, I am the manager. So now the way that you speak to me, I don't know if it's because you think I'm younger than what I am. Is it because I'm a woman, or is it because
it's all of those things. Because you know, I face it from people thinking that you're too young or you're a woman or you're Black. You know, you have like kind of three strikes against you when you're talking talking to someone. But what? How old are your kids?
9 and 5.
Nine and five. Mm-hmm. And your children, Janine?
2, 8, and 9.
2, 8, and 9. Mm-hmm. And do your kids go to predominantly white schools?
I think that my children are just like all other children, is that the better your parents do, the whiter your world gets. Mm-hmm. And that's something else. It concerns me more and more. And I say that because I know that Black excellence exists. And so what we're looking for, I think, are safe spaces for our children. And we want to have safe spaces that are... It's hard to explain. And I say this because I always say this, and I mean it, and I will say it in front of anybody, that I don't want my child to be someone's Black friend. Mm. And when I say that, I don't want him to be, or my daughter to be, the only, and they've been the only in their classes before. And so I know what it's like for them to be that one spec, the one that they always use on the website, the one that they always, use in the literature. Yep. When they have visitors, they have to trot my babies out. And I get that. And I find myself being especially involved in school and making sure that I show up. Oh, yes, I know he got good grades last semester, but I still need a conference. Mm-hmm. Because you'll never single him out. You'll never make him the one. You'll never make him the target. And I understand. And my son is like, I don't say this because I'm his mother, but he is so super cute. And he's really cute. And he has these chubby cheeks. And he has this really outgoing personality. And just by his nature, he's a good boy. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to behave well in school because that's just who he is. He's going to do well. But I know that he's 9 now. What happens when he's 12? Mm-hmm. What happens when he's 12 and the day he doesn't want to behave well in school? The day he doesn't want to follow every direction that you have? So when does he become now not the exception but the rule, the person that you identify as the problem? Whereas if it's his counterpart who happens to be a white boy, oh, such as he had a bad day. I need my son to be able to have bad days. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I don't need him to have to be perfect all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's the constant fight. That's the fight for children. Honestly, that's the fight for Black people just in general, for us to be able to be human. Mm-hmm. Can we just be human? Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm. I have to have conversations with my son all the time because he has been in situations where he was obviously the only Black in the sport, the only Black in his class, the only Black in a choir, whatever it was that he was doing. In his class, there are about 3 of them. Mm-hmm. He consistently gets in trouble and he'll say, oh, well, I was talking to, and I'm not going to use the kid's real name, but I was talking to Billy. Mm-hmm. And both of us were talking, but I got in trouble. And this is consistently his conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, do I understand that part of it is my son not taking ownership for his actions? Yes, I do get that. But I have to also explain to him, listen, honey, at the end of the day, no matter how smart you are, how cute you are, whatever, you're still going to be looked at as less than them. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be considered their equal, and he just does not understand it. And we have this conversation so often, and my fear personally is that it's going to take for a traumatic situation to happen before he realizes, wow, mommy was right.
I think we all get there. We all have those experiences. And as unfortunate as it is, I think that we try our very best to protect our children as much as possible. And there was something else. He also said this in the book about, you know, the parents, the overreaction of parents to beat their children. But it's like, I beat you so that you don't have to be beat by the police. Mm-hmm. And now I think that, you know, as we all learn and grow, and the further we get from slavery, the more that we understand that beatings don't actually work. And that that is something that the oppressed frequently do. And we can't refer to the Bible and say, spare the rod, spoil the child. Because if you're a shepherd, you use your rod to steer. You don't use your rod to beat, because sheep are precious. And it's the same thing with your children. And so I think that it's this, we want so desperately to save them from the world because it's your heart outside of your body walking around, and you know the world hates your heart. How can the world hate this baby? Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel this way about all of the Black men that I have in my life. It is my son. It is my husband. It is my nephew that I hold dear. You know, it's all of the male friends that I have. It's the Black men that I come in contact with daily. And I think about how we have all of these hearts just marching around outside of our body, and they are vulnerable. And as women, you know, a lot of other cultures, the women are the ones that are protected. But as Black women, we've had some shelter, like we said before, we've had some shelter against it. But we fear so much for our men that we try to encapsulate them. Mm-hmm. And we can't protect them. And we've got to hold them responsible. And you know how hard the world is out there. And so you try to coddle them, which happens a lot because you know the world hates your baby. And it's like having an ugly baby. You know, your baby's ugly. You don't want the world to say your baby's ugly because you don't think it's beautiful, even though objectively you see it's ugly. And so you try very, very hard to
coddle. Is that an analogy?
What an ugly Exactly, baby.
Go on.
I would just say from the point of view of the world. Yes. And honestly, from the point of view of the world, if you ever don't ever read the comment section on any article ever, because you will find out that black men are the ugly babies of the world. Mm-hmm. And mothers love those babies. So you can say what you want to say about that baby. You can call black men shiftless. You can say they don't take care of their children. You can say they're ignorant. And I will tell you, lie, and lie on top of lie. That baby is beautiful. Right. Do you know what I mean? Because that's my baby. And I think we also, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm going on.
No, you're fine.
I feel like we also need to change. We need to, for so long, we've not been in control of our narrative. Because when you are, when you realize that you are an oppressed person, and none of us like to believe that we are, because again, we're not enslaved. And again, it's not Jim Crow. So you don't want to think of yourself as an oppressed person because we have these freedoms and we drive these nice cars and we have education and all of these things. But when you realize that you are, and you realize that, I completely forgot where I was going with that one.
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
So, you know, we've been looking at the Stephon Clark situation and his brother, right? And having these outbursts. Mm-hmm. And you said something about safe space, right? Trying to create safe space, but this person was murdered in his safe space. Mm-hmm. Right? And what?
Oh, I remember. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, and everyone, the mom had said something, because I remember someone sending me like, someone needs to pull that boy aside and have a conversation with him. And then he was on Don Lemon's show and he stopped the interview because, I mean, and this guy's obviously in pain, you know, he had, two brothers that had been killed and he's dealing with that pain. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even outside of the police brutality, you know, Parkland.
Yes.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Like Deer Park. Sorry. See, I'm drinking water, right? No, Parkland. And having those conversations with all of these traumatic things happening, what is the conversation with your children? I mean, and when do you start that conversation? Mm-hmm.
You know, children are more aware than we could ever imagine. We think that we shelter them and we try to, again, like I said before, we try to encapsulate them. But they experience the world as well. And so you have to speak to your children to find out what is their experience of the world. And also, if you ever realize, every generation was born for the time that they were in. And so the same way that our ancestors were, and our ancestors were chattel, they were chattel slaves, and you think, I could never do that. I would never do that. They survived that.
Right.
And so when you think about the strength that it took to not only surviving coming from Africa through the Middle Passage and the gruesome horrors that were the Middle Passage to get here, to survive chattel slavery, to have children that were taken from you, your children are built for this time.
Yeah.
So those people were built, they survived that time to pass on so that we could be here. And our children are prepared for this time as well. And so they're wiser than we could ever imagine. If this had happened in the 80s, and I remember Columbine was the first school shooting that I ever became aware of. And the first one, I think, that got national attention. And it was such a shock to us.
Yeah.
And we were afraid, and everybody that had on a trench coat. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, and to talk to my son about school shootings, it's just like, I mean, what, mommy? Mm-hmm. What? Like, they happen. And the same way that we move on, there's a 24-hour news cycle. They might talk about it. And in school, they'll talk about different things, and then they move on. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm most concerned about, more than the children being overly sensitive to the shootings and the violence, is the desensitization that happens.
Right.
And we talked with his brother, and, you know, everybody's, they're talking about pull him off of the news. America, meet your rage. Meet your hurt. This is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And this is what we deal with every day in mental health services. We provide services all over Maryland, but we provide services a lot in Baltimore City. And we do in-home services, and I've been in the home providing a therapy service, and I hit but, you hit gunshots. And so the kids don't flinch. You're like, you know, you'll flinch, you'll duck. Mm-hmm. The
Girl,
kids don't flinch.
On the floor.
Let me tell you why the kids don't flinch. Somebody said, Miss Jada, that was two blocks away. The fact that you can gauge a bullet,
how far,
and you can tell, this is not Iraq, this is not Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Why can you gauge a bullet? This isn't Bosnia in the 90s. Like, what is going on? You can gauge a bullet and tell me that it was two blocks away.
And that is, you know, moving to Baltimore and understanding that realization, you know, and we look at The Wire and you see all the atrocities, right? And people were upset about The Wire, but I'm like,
It's real.
It's real.
It's real.
Right? That's the reality. People mm-hmm. don't have running water mm-hmm. at times. Mm-hmm. People don't have meals. Their mm-hmm. only meals are in schools. mm-hmm. I remember having a conversation with a client of mine, and because I, you know, I was trying to understand this loyalty thing, right?
Like to Baltimore?
yeah.
We ride for it. We love it.
Not even to Baltimore. Just like, it wasn't just Baltimore. It was this loyalty to the, like, I've dated people who would be millionaires mm-hmm. or really well off with their stuff mm-hmm. and they would still be hanging on the corner mm-hmm. right mm-hmm. well traveled, all kinds of stuff, right mm-hmm. but still be hanging on the corner with the people that they went to school with or whatever it is, right mm-hmm. and I'm just like, why would you know
because it's home,
right? And it mm-hmm. was home. And I had a conversation with my client because he said, you know, he was you know, running a $1 million company. Mm-hmm. And he said that he was still living in Park Heights. And he said there was a white van that was at the down the block from mm-hmm. his house. And he said that he just saw kids running up and in and out of the van. Right. And he's just like, what's all this activity going mm-hmm. on in the van? So he walks down the street and he sees a dead body mm-hmm. in this van.
Wow.
Right.
You never seen a dead body yeah. before?
Who, me? I've never seen a dead body before. But
he grew up in Baltimore.
I've
seen a few.
Really?
Yes. What?
County girl? See? Listen, you was in the wrong part.
No, I was outside of my house.
What?
I left off for school in the morning. There was a dead body. But people don't understand the county isn't that much better than the city. It's depending not, on what part of the county you live in. And I grew up in Woodlawn. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I admitted it out loud. I always say Kagansville. But I grew up in Woodlawn. It was better. Let me not say it wasn't any better, but it was still bad.
Hennessy Coates, he graduated from Woodlawn High School.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I said, reading his book, you know, mm-hmm. The Beautiful Struggle, that's when I first, mm-hmm. you know, was conscious of him as an author. And I remember him discussing, you know, having the pressure of the streets mm-hmm. and the codes and then also, you know, having to go to school yep. and, you know, all this stuff. But my client, you know, go back to my client, he said that was a realization for him. He was like, this is normal. Mm-hmm. This has become normal. No one has called the police. No one has screamed. These kids are like, oh my God, look. And it's a spectacle, right? Yep. And he was like, I gotta leave. My son, I have to leave. Yeah. I have to take my son out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, and his loyalty for trying to be, you know, even though he had made it, uh-huh. he was still trying to be down and mm-hmm. still like in Park Heights, mm-hmm. you know, and he had to leave because he's like, this cannot become normal to my son. Mm-hmm. This can
and what's the thing we have to realize is that this can't be normal for anyone's son.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
And so those of us who have done well, we have to reach back. And I think that now there's this wave of consciousness that's coming over Black people where we realize that success isn't necessarily surrounding yourselves with the trappings of white people or mm-hmm. well-to-do people. That's not necessarily what success is. And when you've achieved that success, there's more than enough for everyone if we right. believe that there's more than enough for everyone. And also, there has to be a shift in our, we have to shift our view to see that those of us who quote-unquote make it mm-hmm. are the anomaly. Mm. You're the ones who beat the system. Yes. Everyone else who did not make it, they did exactly what the system intended for them to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you have to realize that if we're going to break the system, we then have to we have to make sure that we understand that there's more than enough.
Yes.
And that we need to share knowledge. The Bible says, and I will quote it, my people perish for lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so we are African Americans do not pass on knowledge from person to person to person. We teach each other how to survive. Mm. That is the knowledge that we teach. My mother has taught me, there's never been a day that I have starved. I have never been homeless. And she taught me something. She said, we do it by hook or by crook, meaning that if it's got to get done, we're going to get it done. Yeah. But what she didn't, and this is no fault of her own at all, is that she didn't teach me how to move beyond that point. Mm-hmm. And so I'll go back to the Bible again, but I always say to my nephew, I'm very close to him. He's only 14 years younger than me. And so what I always tell him is that Nana was Moses and we are Joshua. And if you don't know about that in the Bible, Moses took the people out of bondage and through the wilderness, but he didn't see him to the promised land. Joshua mm-hmm. was the one that he studied under Moses. He was Moses' servant and he took the people to the promised land. So mm-hmm. we've had people who had to get us through the wilderness. It's time for us to take the next level and reach back and take our people. And if, again, I'm going to reference the Bible, they were the when they wandered through the wilderness, the Israelites, they were not like a band of jolly, merry people to walk through. They were trifling and ratchet, yes. And you know, and broken and traumatized, much like people who were enslaved. So these were enslaved people. So you have to understand that when you have a culture of people in a society who were enslaved and then almost break, you're almost blamed for the result in the trauma that resulted from your enslavement. Mm. So we now have to, those of us who can see it for what it is, have to reach back and grab our people and say, listen, we didn't have anybody to show us. This is how you do this. Yeah. This is how you do that. We don't have to do these maladaptive behaviors. We don't have to buy into this culture, because believe me when I tell you that gang culture and drug culture are given to us. It was given to us as an acceptable means of providing and supporting ourselves and then entrapping us in prison. Please understand, you are working within the system when you sell drugs and when you participate in gangs. This is the way it's set up to be. And when you defy that and you choose not to, you're the ultimate rebel and you're working against the system. So if we can teach this to our children and teach this to the youth out there, if you've ever been on the corner, again, I say I grew up in Baltimore. If you've ever been on a corner or you knew a corner boy or you dated a drug dealer, you will realize that they are usually hella smart, hella hardworking, very ingenious. And so you'll have these guys, and not everyone, but they didn't have a way to channel that intellect. They didn't have a means to channel it through. So when you realize that, and you realize we've got all of this rough product here, because believe me, the powers that be know that all of that rough product is there, which is why it will constantly be, we've got to thin it out. Let's thin out the herd.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also based on economics, right?
Yes.
And there's systems in place. Mm-hmm. When we look at where Mike Brown was from, and when we talk about, you know, that whole system has been dismantled. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They were, you know, the people, the police officers were giving tickets, right? to an alarming rate to the poorer blacks, you know, to fill their quota.
Of course.
And then that puts people in a cycle, right? And then you can't go to work. And, you know, and it affects a whole lot of other things. Yes. That's a part of the system. Mm-hmm. And I said, growing up in New York, you grow up in a certain way. And I've lived in several different cities. I don't know if you guys have lived in different cities, but I've lived in several different cities. And coming to Baltimore, there is a drug culture, right? And I think that a lot of people have adopted this drug culture mentality. Mm-hmm. And even if you grew up in a county, if you ever grew up wherever it is, it was odd to me, right? Because I'm like, what is the matter with you? Nobody's out to get you. Chill out, you know, like, what is, you know, I just felt this kind of animosity and this mind, you know, mentality that just was foreign to me. And, you know, dating certain people here, it was just kind of like, and I had to, even women, my friends, just the way they dealt with guys. And,
it's the get money, like a hustler's mentality.
It's a hustler, it was a hustler mentality. And I was just like,
Because I'm sorry. You're taught early on that it is a dog eat dog world, and you have to really be mindful of yourself and how you interact with other people and the vulnerabilities that come with that.
Yes.
Because if it's all, what did they say? It's all in a game. Like, it's all part of the game. And so everybody has a part to play in the game, but you have to ask yourself, how was the game created and who created it? Yeah. And so again, I always, it's specifically in Baltimore, but if you look at Baltimore, I just want to kind of bring to people's attention that there's a lot of wealth in Baltimore as well. Yeah. And so you have all of these people who live in Baltimore, African-Americans. We have so many colleges and universities in Baltimore, and they are not accessible to the majority of the population here. People come to Baltimore to go to college. People come to Baltimore to go to the University of Maryland. They come to Baltimore to go to Hopkins. They come to Baltimore to go to Loyola. Go into the projects or go down in West Baltimore, down a hill in East Baltimore, and you ask people, where's Loyola College?
They have no clue.
And I think it's a hinder. I really think the culture is a hinder, because I feel like a lot of people like myself and other people that have come from other places have made the most of Baltimore.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people who sometimes live here, they're like, you like Baltimore? Like, you like Baltimore? I want to get out of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm always getting that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what you hate so much about Baltimore?
Because
you know?
You're taught that it's, you have the narrative is written for you.
Yeah.
and you're taught to hate where you live. I remember, I grew up, I tell everybody, I grew up on 38th and Greenmount. And so there's Greenmount Avenue, there's 38th Street. And if you go over in 38th Street, we lived in our row houses. And I won't even get into the specifics of the row houses because my mother don't like me to talk about it because we've moved beyond that. But, but you know, we lived there in those row houses. And across Greenmount Avenue is 39th Street with million-dollar homes and mansions. And for some reason, it never occurred to us to cross the street. We just never cross the street. If you're in a car, you drive through. You don't wander around that neighborhood because it was not for you.
Yeah, and I always get that. And people always, when I go to different cities, they're like, you're a champion for Baltimore. And I'm like, I like Baltimore. Like, it's a great city. And it's because I never came in with that mentality that Baltimore was... You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Horrible. The people, and I said, any urban city has their issues, right? I've lived in Philly. I grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. I lived in Hampton. So I spent a lot of time in D.C. And I see the different types of mentalities and I see the different types of culture. And I see what holds people back here. Mm-hmm. And I said, and it happens in Detroit, probably happens in St. Louis, that they're not making the most of their city.
They're not exploring it. I always say that about people in Baltimore. Like, you don't explore your city. We have so many jewels and they're not hidden jewels. I don't like to use that word. Like,
no, they're out in the open, but it, as I said, it is the system. So how do you have your kids, like, what do you do? Because you're a mom, right? And you're having different struggles. You know, you may not be as blessed as you and Janine, right? And how do you have those conversations to break that cycle?
I think the first thing we have to do, and I remember what I was saying earlier, is that we have to control our own narrative. For so long, since we came to this country, people have told us who we are. And we have to change the narrative that everything that is associated with Black for Black people is a bad thing. So many people benefit from Black culture and they enjoy Black culture, but we have been taught to be ashamed of it and to distance ourselves from it, which is why we use terms like, oh, that's so ghetto. What exactly does that mean?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of good things that come out of the ghetto, myself being one of them. You know, it's a lot of good things there, but it's just another way to say that's so Black. If we're being honest, it is. And so even when you look at things like... In New York, when they had, it was African American, it was Black History Month, and they had done fried chicken and something and collard greens or whatever for the lunch in the cafeteria. Black people were so angry about this. So what I say to that is, why were we angry about this? We eat fried chicken.
We eat
collard greens. And it's something that we actually embrace. And if you come to a Black gathering or a cookout and it's not there, you're like, well, who in the world, if we just have hot dogs at a cookout, we're like, what's going on? You know what I mean? But the thing is, it symbolizes Blackness, which is why we're offended by it. Like, oh, we don't all eat that. Of course. And all Asian people don't eat Chinese food. But if it were the Chinese New Year and they did dim sum, there wouldn't be an issue. There wouldn't be a problem because that culture embraces its culture. And when you can embrace your culture, you can be proud of the things associated with your culture.
But do you think with that it becomes a stereotype? Not just, you know, I think that there has been a new wave of Blackness and celebrating of Blackness, right? But then there's stereotypes, right? That kind of, as you said, limit people. And that you won't cross the street because you are locked into this stereotype.
Wait, I think there are two separate things. I think that the not crossing the street is because you think that you put boundaries and parameters on yourself and you think that you're not allowed to, or I'm not good enough to.
Even but unconsciously.
Unconsciously. Most of it is unconscious. You just think...
Because you're falling into the stereotype.
Yeah, but I think they're two different things. I think the stereotypes are different. They're things that we identify, that we think that other people identify as by, like, all Black people like rap music, or we like fried chicken and collard greens. But I think that the two are different. The stereotype, I don't think, justifies or classifies the reason why we put limits and boundaries on ourselves. I've said on episodes before that growing up, I just always thought, oh, she's white, she's got to be smart. That's not necessarily a stereotype. That's an insecurity in myself.
It's actually internalized depression is what it is. It's internalized.
It is. It's what we've always been taught. Or, my hair doesn't necessarily look like the hair.
Good hair.
So now that must mean that my hair is bad. Or things that I definitely grew up thinking that whiter was better and I was less than. And it wasn't until I started realizing, like we talked about this before, when I got to Hampton, I was like, hold on. This is a different world. And everyone here is great. And we're all Black. So I say all that to say that I don't think that the stereotypes and the limiting ourselves are the same. I think, like you said, one is oppression and one is just ignorance.
Mm. I don't think that, I think that what you have to do is you have to reject the stereotype and the offense of the stereotype. And I don't mean, Pete, what you were saying before about being, I don't think it makes you super sensitive to say that you won't disrespect me in that way and that's disrespectful. Right. But what I mean when I say that is don't accept it. I reject it. I reject any notion that because I'm an African-American woman and because I affirm myself that I'm somehow a black bitch.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I reject that. Yeah. I reject that because I'm black, I'm less than. I reject the fact that I reject any notion about my hair being either good or bad because I won't. You can't have that because you can. All of the things on the outside you can control. You can control this government. Mm-hmm. You can control the laws. You can control the land. But you can't control my mind and how I feel about myself. Right. So I reject that. You won't. You will not convince me that black is wrong. Mm-hmm. That black is bad. You won't do it and with a microaggression. You won't do it with a full-on aggression. Yeah. You can say what you want to say out of your mouth, but you will never convince me of that. You can say nigger all you want to. You want to know why? Because I'm not one. Mm-hmm. So who the hell are you talking to? Do you understand what I'm saying? And so when I say that, I don't say to invite people to call me a nigger because I can't, you know, again, I grew up off of Green Mountain 38th Street. So some things.
You only
some,
so far.
Some
moves.
Things I can't. But when I say that, I just mean that we have to determine who we are. Mm-hmm. And I think that as black people, like you were saying before, Sanjay, your family's from Guyana. Mm-hmm. Because of that, you have a cultural identity. Mm-hmm. But I think that black people in America don't realize that we too have a cultural identity. Right, and it's not an identity to be ashamed of. Again, I think we changed the narrative and you see it for what it was. We have ancestors who were stripped and taken from Africa, from the loved ones that they love, the same way that we're talking about how I love my son and I love my husband and my daughter and my nephew and my family. The same way they love them. You know, we love our family. They love them. They were stripped away, taken on boats, pecked beyond like sardines with death and disease and rape and brutality and being brutalized over 3 months of the Middle Passage, dropped off, chattel slavery, sold, not allowed to speak your language, not allowed to practice your religion, and you survived. And what we have to understand is that those who didn't survive, those who jumped into the water and those who died, we are the descendants of the survivors.
We are.
So the strongest among them, and not to say anything about those who didn't, because it was horrific, but the strongest among them, we are the stock of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How can you have any kind of humiliation? How can you have any kind of, how can you reject that? How can you reject that your ancestors were literally the strongest of people who were stolen and survived? I can't. Like, I can't. I've never worked for 18 hours straight outside in the freezing cold and in the blistering sun. I've never picked cotton until my fingers bled. I've never, you know, ate just a handful of grain or whatever was left over. I've never given birth in a field, got patched up the next day or the later that day back out again. So when you think about that, there's no shame associated with blackness.
Right.
There's no shame associated with that. So anything that came after that, how can I be ashamed of that? Mm-hmm. You want to know why? Like we were talking about fried chicken and collard greens. You want to know why we ate collard greens? Because they were considered weeds. Mm-hmm. And that's what they gave us. And you gave us weeds and we made a magical dish out of it. That actually happens to be high in iron and, you know, a lot of vitamins and all of that. But vitamin C too. But do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
So we have to change the narrative of that. The same way that we have, like I said before, with all of these dope boys that are on the streets and all of that kind of stuff, that's ingenuity out there. That is untapped ingenuity. And I always have to ask, because this isn't just in America. It's a global issue that we have with black people and black bodies all over this globe. Yeah. What is it that is so special about a people that the whole world has to conspire to keep that people down?
Yes.
That's all. Yeah. That's just.
Yeah. And yes, you are. And I said, we are Wakanda forever over here. But no. I mean, and I said, I was very moved to tears from that performance, and it's a shame that it's not going to be done several times for people to see it, you know, because I said everyone is kind of more, if Beyonce ain't go see it, then it, you know, nobody paying attention, right? Only like a certain, you know, bunch of probably black intellectuals or people who are more culturally involved now, you know, feel that it was important to actually purchase tickets to actually see that performance. But As I said, you know, he's going to be here May 17th. If you want to follow up and see some of his work, we're going to post, you know, some information about his book. And New York Times wrote a great article about it, explaining about what it is about his book about Between the World and Me, if you've never heard about it. But, you know, Jada, please give us some information. If people want to talk to you about having these conversations with their children, how can they reach you?
Oh, you can go to our website, which is www.btstservices.com. And there we provide outpatient mental health treatment in the communities. We do it on site and off site because we want to just make sure that our resources are for everyone. And so we won't let lack of income or lack of transportation stop you from coming in to get mental health treatment. So our goal is to, I always say that our goal is to heal hearts and minds and heal families and then heal communities. So that's what we do here.
Thank you very much. P. Chris, what you got for us? Some little Cardi? Yeah.
Take us out.
Came through dripping. Diamonds on my wrist, they dripping. Ice. Came through dripping. Diamonds on my wrist, they dripping.
Ice. Came through dripping. Came through dripping. Diamonds on my wrist, they tripping. Came through drippin'. Diamonds on my wrist, they trippin'.
Race. Give me a little something to remember. Tryna make love in a sprinter. Yeah. Quit you dropping like Kimber. Looking like a right swipe on Tinder.